Well, good morning. It's good to see you all. My name's Graeme Nichols, one of the leaders of the church here, and we are working through the letter that Paul wrote to the church in Corinth, a letter we call 1 Corinthians, and we're looking at the whole of chapter 8 this morning. Let me begin by introducing you to a bird. This bird is called the Great Frigate Bird, from the Galapagos Islands. And the male of this species has a gular sac. And male of the species sits in bushes or trees at the mating season. And for about 20 minutes, kind of breathes and puffs and does various contortions to inflate this gular sac up to the sort of proportionate size that you see there. And of course, you would probably know, having watched nature programs over the years, that he does that to attract females. He is puffed up. He is blown up. He is full of hot air. He is full of himself with his great red gula sack. And really the question this morning is a simple one for us as Christian believers. Do you have a gula sack? And is it full? Is it puffed up? Is it inflated? Are you trying to attract people to yourselves? What is the purpose of your gula sack? That's what we're about this morning in 1 Corinthians chapter 8. Let's look at it together. So the first thing to look at really from verses 1 to 3 is that you might have knowledge, but without love, it just leads to pride. You might have knowledge, but without love, it just leads you to pride. Paul begins now about food sacrificed to idols. And what he's really doing is introducing a new topic. He often in the letter of the Corinthians says, now about something. So he's saying, now about this thing. So now about food sacrificed to idols. There were obviously questions or comments in a letter that the Corinthians had written to Paul. You'll remember that this letter, 1 Corinthians, was written in response to a letter that they wrote about various issues. There's some of the sexual issues that we looked at previously, and now this one to do with food sacrificed to idols. And in particular, he's talking about meat, not just food in general, but meat that has been offered to idols. Meat that had been used in the temple rituals in Corinth in some way or other, and the butcher had perhaps offered the whole animal up in the temple and then taken various parts of the animal, and they were then available for sale in the market. And you have to realize that the idol temples were not just an obscure part of the culture, like maybe churches have become now for us in our culture. The idol temples were at the center of Corinthian culture. They weren't just a sort of minority sport. They were what everyone was involved in. And it wasn't just that you went there to do your religious stuff. It was really the center for all social occasions. So if you were having a celebration, a wedding party, or a birthday, or whatever else you wanted to celebrate, then you would often have that in the temple. If you were kind of doing the equivalent of going out to a restaurant to celebrate something, you wouldn't go to a restaurant, you'd go to the idol temple, and you'd eat the meat there. So it was really where you hang out. It was really the center of community life for them. Plus, the obvious pagan temple worship that went on there too. And the question really about this food offered to idols and whether they should eat it, whether they should buy it, whether they should serve it, that kind of question is running right the way through to chapter 10 of 1 Corinthians. So really it's in your mind, should be in your mind as you're working through, right to a conclusion towards the end of chapter 10 where Paul kind of brings down some actual rules about whether they should eat the meat in the market, or whether they should buy the meat in the market, whether they should eat the meat at a friend's house, whether they should be involved in things in the temple itself. So he does come to a conclusion, but he works to it fairly gently and works through some general principles first. So then he says in verse 1, we know that we all possess knowledge. And what he's doing is something that he's often done in Corinthians, which is to quote them back at them. So he's almost certainly using a catchphrase of theirs where they would say something like, we all possess knowledge. Not kind of a general observation they're making. They're probably making it in a sort of arrogant way about their special knowledge. If you've kind of studied the Bible a bit, the word gnosis, the word knowledge, the idea of special knowledge, of insight that kind of comes from heaven was a real Greek idea that was around. So probably it meant quite a lot when they said, we all possess knowledge, when they said that. But he kind of quotes it back to them, and to some degree, he confirms it. But he says, without love, it's useless. So he says, knowledge puffs up, love builds up. Knowledge means having information and insight. Knowledge could mean being superior in the insight that you have. But Paul says the fruit of mere knowledge, the fruit of just knowledge, is pride, is being puffed up, being like the frigate bird, parading, attracting, a big red lump on the front of our throat. That's what knowledge is without love. That expression, puffed up, and the idea of pride, is right through, actually, the letter to Corinth. So in chapter 4, he uses exactly the same phrase. Sometimes it's translated puffed up, sometimes it's translated pride. But through chapter 4, he says there are people who are following Apollos, and there are people who are following Paul, and there's people saying they're following Christ, and people say they're following Peter. And you're all puffed up in your pride. You're boasting about who you're following, which club you're in. In chapter 5, they're talking about immorality, or Paul's talking about their immorality. And he says you're puffed up in declaring that you're free to be immoral. And then he gets that great conclusion in chapter 13, verse 4, which you're very familiar with, that the famous love passage. And one of the expressions he uses is, love is not proud. And it's the same word, love is not puffed up. So obviously pride was a big issue in Corinth, and pride is always a big issue for us. Knowledge puffs up, love builds up. But more than that, he says, pride actually shows your ignorance. It's not as if you actually do know everything and you're being proud, which would be bad enough. But he says, worse than that, by your pride and by your actions, you're actually showing you know less than you think you know. Those of you who think you know must realize that you don't know. See verse 2, the man who thinks he knows something does not yet know as he ought to know. If you think you're full up with knowledge, you're just showing that you're not full up with knowledge at all. And certainly by your actions, you're showing that you don't know. What's missing, he says, is the man who loves God and is known by God reflects the love of God. Because love will build up, but knowledge alone will puff up. So your knowledge, he says, it's incomplete, it's inadequate, and it's dangerous and it's damaging. Now, Paul doesn't say knowledge and learning is wrong. The Bible's full of information. We encourage you to study the Bible, to work it out, to write things down, to read other books, to figure out what it's saying. And Paul would never be saying knowledge is a bad thing, information about God is a bad thing. But there is something inadequate about knowledge on its own. There is something really important about the application of knowledge. And if we apply knowledge wrongly, then we're just showing we haven't learned anything at all. So Paul says, you might have knowledge, but without love, it just leads to pride. That's the first three verses of that section. And then verses 4-8, he says, you know that an idol is nothing. At least some of you do, but some people might think of them as gods. You know, the people he's particularly targeting here, you know that an idol is nothing, but there are some people who think of them as gods. So Paul is really taking the general principle now about love and knowledge, and he's applying it to the case that he's already raised about the idols in the temple, sorry, the meat offered to the idols in the temple. And he quotes them again, probably, when he says, an idol is nothing. They would have said to him, perhaps in their letter, an idol is nothing. And also, there is no God but one. And Paul wants to say, absolutely, I agree with you. You're correct. An idol is nothing. He will say a bit later on that he believes the temple is a place of demons. And he obviously believes in the reality of demons and the devil and spiritual forces. But in terms of being a god, he agrees with them. An idol is nothing. There is only one God. There are many authorities in the world. There are many spiritual beings in the universe, in the whole created world. There are many authorities, there are many powers, there are many lords, yes, he says, but there is only one God. And there is only one Father God, and there is only one Son God. There is only one God, verse 6, the Father, from whom all things came, and for whom we live, and there is but one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom all things came, and through whom, or for whom, we live. It's interesting, isn't it? It's an identical, pretty much, description of God the Father and God the Son. The same attributes for God the Father as God the Son, because truly, God the Son is God. Just notice that in passing. But because of that, idols are nothing. And Paul wants to affirm that before he goes on to teach anything else. It's worth just saying, if you're someone here this morning who doesn't believe in God, in the God of the Bible, that what the Bible is declaring to you this morning, what Paul is saying to you, what God is saying to you this morning is there is only one God. God doesn't fit in a sort of general category of gods, a broad category of gods and spirituality and forces and powers and ways of meeting our needs. Yet there's only one God. There are powerful people in the world. There are spiritual forces that we can't always explain. There are things that seem to work and we don't quite know why. There are good characteristics of various religions. The discipline of Ramadan is probably a good thing, to fast in the way that they do. I'm sure Mahatma Gandhi was a good bloke and said lots of wise and useful things. But ultimately, in terms of God, there's only one. There's only one God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. There's only the one, and he's the one who made you and for whom you exist. If you're here this morning and don't realize that, I have to tell you that you live for God. You were made for God. You were made to know God. That is your purpose. Are you wondering? Are you scrabbling around thinking, why am I here? What am I doing? Well, here it is. You are made for God, for his purposes. You are made to know him and just him. There are no other gods that you need to know. And we need to recognize that. But returning to verse 7, Paul says, that's true, there's only one God, but not everyone knows this, he says. Idols are nothing, but this is a fact that some people think idols are something. There are some people back in Corinth who are still thinking that. You see, there would have been people who became Christians and they'd spent the whole of their lives, just imagine, the whole of their lives, going to the temple regularly, often, for loads of things, for the actual worship, rituals, for celebrations, for having meals together, every kind of family occasion, you'd be in the temple. So that their whole life was bound up in that. And through all that experience, the impression, the feeling that the idols were something, that they somehow were gods, was very strong for them. And now they're following Jesus. We know that from verse 11. It's a brother or a sister. This week, brother for whom Christ died, brother or sister for whom Christ died, it being destroyed. So we know that it's Christians that Paul is thinking about. But it's Christians who haven't quite figured out what Paul has just said. They haven't quite figured out there is only one God. And they haven't quite got there in thinking, no, the idols are nothing. They have no power. They have no force. There's no reality to them. And for them, going to the temple, and in particular eating meat associated with the temple, was just bound up with the reality of the idols And for them, it seemed like the wrong thing to do. Not everyone knows this. He says they're so accustomed to idols that when they eat such food, that they just can't stop thinking about the fact that it had been associated with idol worship. They can't disconnect the meat from the temple. And Paul says it doesn't make any difference, of course. You know, the food you're going to eat, it doesn't bring you closer to God. You may be able to make a divine lasagna or cheesecake or something, but it's not going to bring you closer to God by being a wonderful piece of food, and it's not going to take you away from God by being a piece of food that's been offered to an idol. That is true, but some people haven't quite figured that out yet, he says. People are at different stages, and if you ignore that, then you're using your knowledge without the love. So you might think an idol's nothing, and you'd be right, Paul says, but some people still think of them as gods. So thirdly, be very careful, he says, how you use your knowledge and how you exercise your rights. Big principle, love, not just knowledge. Some people are confused, even though an idol is nothing. So what's the conclusion? Be very careful how you use your knowledge and how you exercise your rights. You're completely free to use this meat, but just hold on a minute, says Paul. You're free, but be sure that you're not being a stumbling block, something that causes your brother or your sister to trip over. Here's a weak Christian. Here's a baby Christian. Here's a Christian who hasn't quite figured it out yet. And here's you. And you're seemingly a mature Christian. You're seemingly someone who has the knowledge, someone who seems to be very well informed about spiritual things. And here the weak Christian is going by the temple, and they see you there in the temple. And they see you eating meat in the temple. They observe that, and they can't get their head around it. What is going on? Why is it all right for them to eat in the temple? Maybe it's just a social event. You're not participating in the ritual. Maybe it's your best friend's birthday and you just happen to be there eating the meat there. Probably for most people, by the way, it was the only place where they ate meat. Most of the rest of the time they would have had a vegetarian diet, but the temple was probably the only place where they ate meat. So that's why you would have gone there for the special celebration. So here you are celebrating and someone goes by and they see you and they're ruined by it. Because you're just kicking back. The actual expression for eating here in the idol temple is reclining at table, meaning just chilling out, kicking back at the temple, and you're seen doing that. And the immature Christian thinks, ah, maybe it's all right, this whole idol worship thing. Maybe it's all right to have God, the true God, and Jesus Christ, his Son, and to have other idols as well. Maybe I need a whole cabinet full of idols in order to be really safe. Maybe I can actually go and participate in the whole ritual, but in my heart I can be worshipping the true God. All these thoughts that are set off in this immature Christian's mind. And Paul says this is now causing them to go against their own convictions, against what their conscience is telling them. And actually, more than we sometimes think, Paul is very respectful of our consciences. When we go against our consciences, and of course they need to be informed by the word of God, but Paul says here and elsewhere in Romans that when we go against our conscience, there's a sin in that. When we do the wrong that we know that we shouldn't do, even if perhaps we might be misinformed at this point, when we do wrong kind of willfully, when we do something that we think is wrong, then that's a sin in itself. So Paul says, by doing this, you're destroying your brother. Verse 11, this weak brother for whom Christ died is destroyed by your knowledge. It's a very strong expression he uses, isn't it? Paul uses it from the perspective of Christ and his death. And he says, this weak brother for whom Christ died. Here's a person, the one who's walking by while you're eating at the temple, and there's someone for whom Christ has died. Christ loved him. Christ gave his life for this brother or sister. And you're just disrespecting them. Christ loved them so much. How much do you love them? Not at all. You're just puffed up with what you know and your freedom and what you can do. You have no love like Christ had for them. And actually, even more than that, he says, you're sinning against Christ. Verse 12, see that? When you sin against your brother in this way and wound their weak consciences, you sin against Christ. That's probably these two verses are probably the most shocking verses in there, because the rest seems kind of reasonable wisdom, you know, be love, be caring. But when he actually says, when you do this, you're sinning against Christ, kind of raises the stakes really high, doesn't it? It's not a trivial matter. It's not a matter of, oh, we can have a bit of a kind of knockabout discussion about this. He says, when you do this, you're actually persecuting, sinning against, wronging Christ as you ignore your brother's weak conscience. Yes, he's wrong. Yes, he's got it muddled up. But when you force him to sin by your action, or cause him to sin by your action, you're sinning against Christ. So much so then that Paul says, verse 13, therefore, if what I eat causes my brother to fall into sin, I will never eat meat again. I will not cause him to fall. Paul says, and meat eaters among you would know what sacrifice this would be. Paul says, if by not eating meat for the rest of my life, I make sure that I don't cause my brother to fall, I'm quite willing to do that because it's that serious for me. That's what Paul says in these verses. Two very simple lessons to make from it. And I suppose the overarching question is, do we have a head full of knowledge or do we have a heart full of love? Do we have a head full of knowledge or do we have a heart full of love? Paul says, use spiritual insight lovingly. If God has graciously given you some understanding of his word, if you know some stuff from the Bible, the question is, how are you going to use it? Because Christian knowledge is supposed to build us up and supposed to build our brothers and sisters up. And it's a real mark of being spiritually immature if you know loads of stuff but you don't know how to apply it in love. If you know lots of Bible, if you know lots of theology, meaning the study of God, if you can say lots of clever phrases, use lots of theological words, but don't apply them in love, then you don't know anything at all. We want to study the Bible. We want to hear from God. But if we're just filling up our heads with information, that's incomplete. But worse than that, it's destructive. It's loveless. Really, by knowing lots of theology without love, we just become windbags. Do you want to be a windbag? Do you want to be a frigate bird full of knowledge about the Bible but having no love? Use the spiritual insight you have with love. I was reading a couple of days ago a list of things that you're not supposed to do if you're leading a small group Bible study. And I think I've done all of those things that you're not supposed to do at one time or other. And a couple of them connect with this. One is to say, that was a stupid question. Someone asked a question in a small group, I was, that was a stupid question. Or to say, you didn't know that. You didn't realize that. Or to say, well, obviously, dot, dot, dot. Sometimes, in all sorts of contexts, we want to reel off our Bible knowledge. We want to reel off what we know, but we're not thinking purpose. Why are we doing that? It's good to have words that describe things, and sometimes that's essential, but if you want to use Calvinism or soteriology or eschatology or some other complicated Bible word that has more than two syllables, think about it. Think purpose. Why are you doing it? Does this express love, or does this just show that you're really smart? Think purpose. Think about how you talk about other Christians and how you talk about other churches. We can consider ourselves to be a church that has knowledge. We're really serious about studying the Bible. That's a great thing. God's blessed us with lots of Bible teaching over many years. Be thankful to God for that. Enjoy that. But think, okay, so what am I going to do with it? Am I going to look down my nose at other churches or other Christians who are ignorant to say, oh, they still do that? Look at people who are perhaps old-fashioned and still using the authorized version and look down my nose at them and say, of course, translations is nothing. I remember, I think I've told you before, I worked in an electronics factory once, and up in London, near Great Dover Street. And there was a lady from a Caribbean church there, and we were talking about Bible versions. I was sitting soldering and stuff like that, and she said to me, in all sincerity, "If the Authorized Version was good enough for St. Paul, it's good enough for me." Now, we you're not even laughing at that, because perhaps you don't even think that's funny. But I thought it was funny at the time. But we can look down our noses at people and say, well, that's just ignorance. Doesn't she realize that the Bible was written in, the New Testament was written in Greek, and that, you know, Paul didn't even have a completed Bible, but he certainly didn't have the Authorized Version, which was written in the 1600s. She's so ignorant. But this is the lady who came in every day singing hymns, and this is the lady who loved Jesus. This is a lady for whom Jesus died. This is a lady that I need to be very careful about how I talk to and how I talk about. Because knowledge just puffs up, but love will build up. Love will seek to think, okay, so there is some ignorance there, so maybe we need to find a way to fill that hole, but without pressing down, without patronizing this person. And we can do that with individuals. We can do that with other churches. We can think about people who are having all kinds of different practices. We were, I was talking briefly with Jim earlier about the whole sort of cult of burning Harry Potter books that kind of grew up in the States when Harry Potter was out. And you could reach all kinds of conclusions about that, but about whether that was a good thing or a bad thing. But fundamentally, a book, a piece of literature is nothing, we might say, but not to look down on those who have a different view. So use spiritual insight lovingly, but perhaps even more so here, be careful how you use your freedom. Be careful how you use your freedom. I'm not sure there is a perfect equivalent in the modern day between the meat offered to idols and things that are happening in our lives. It's hard to make a direct parallel. It's very easy, actually, to decide the things that are in that category. And then we decide that we're the stronger brother and everyone else is the weaker brother. So that's a kind of a warning note in front of anything else that I might say. Things are not so clear-cut as to which is which issue. Some things are just plain wrong, and we need to realize that they're wrong. Our brother or sister need to tell us that they're wrong, and we need to realize that ourselves. But just think of this example, which I think is okay. There's a new convert, Jane. And she used to drink a lot, so much so she could hardly remember her name by the end of it. And she used to smoke everything that was available to smoke, some legal, some illegal. And she used to go clubbing and love it. And sometimes she could remember afterwards. And she came to Christ, and all of that stopped for her. So there's Jane, and she had a friend called Jenny, and Jenny had been a Christian a bit longer. In fact, Jenny is the one who'd helped her start coming along to church and hear about Jesus. But Jenny, because she's been a Christian a bit longer, had realized that intrinsically there was nothing wrong with alcohol. It was something which God had provided on this earth, was a good thing. So she'd realized that. She'd been taught that, and so she thought it was okay to drink. And, which is maybe not quite so easy to argue, but she thought that clubbing occasionally was a good thing to do. She loved dancing. She thought it was quite fun and innocent, and she loved having a great night out going clubbing. But the new convert, Jane, is shocked. Shocked and confused. And in fact, by her friendship, she's drawn back into that whole world of drinking and smoking and clubbing and parading herself, and is drawn back into that whole world and ends up much worse off than she was in the first place. She is confused, she is drawn down, and she is destroyed by it. You see, Jenny, the person who's been a Christian for a while, she hasn't thought about this text. She hasn't thought, okay, so I might be right in my assessment. Alcohol, non-alcohol is nothing, but or clubbing and not clubbing is nothing. I might be right in my assessment, but I'm not thinking love. I'm not thinking, here's my dear sister for whom Christ died. And my dear sister has a history with this and all sorts of problems and associations. That has been her life and she has left that life. And I'm just dragging her back into it. I'm not thinking love. I'm just thinking knowledge. I'm thinking freedom. I'm thinking rights. I'm exercising my rights. I'm quite free to go clubbing whenever I want to, as long as I don't actually sin in some way. That's what she's saying, but she's not thinking love. And maybe sometimes we are not thinking love. Do you care about your brother or sister? Do you care about the one for whom Christ died and gave his life? Do you realize that when you defile their conscience, you're actually sinning against Christ? If it actually helped somebody not to sin, would you be a vegetarian for the rest of your life? Would you give up something? Are you willing to give up something that you know is not wrong? As far as God has taught you up to this point in your life, you know this thing is not wrong, but you'd be willing to give it up if it helped somebody not sin. Would you be willing to do that? No, you wouldn't perhaps, because you're thinking rights. You're thinking, I'm right in the head and I have rights. And Paul says, no, you're not. You don't know anything if you don't know this, that love is more important. And these things are difficult, aren't they? Are you free to hold a wedding reception in a lap dancing club? Just assume for a moment that the lap dancing is not going on at the time. Are we free to do that? I think we are. Sack me later. I think we are in principle, but aren't the associations so strong with that? And maybe you hold a social event there because it's so cheap during the daytime to get a place. Maybe it's not cheap during the daytime. But anyway, certain times of the day it might be cheap to hire the local lap dancing club. I don't know if there even is one in Haversheath, but let's assume there is, and we shift my son's wedding reception to there instead of wherever it's going to be in Exmouth area. I'm free to do that, but is it helpful? Is it loving? Are there people perhaps who in their past used to go there? Are there people for whom the association with it or the images that are on the wall in there or just the whole kind of mentality of going there is wrong for them? Or are there people who are going by, people who are not yet Christians or are young Christians and they don't know it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon and the lap dancers have all gone home. They see you in there and they think, oh, so it's all right then. Or maybe you want to go to the lap dancing club anyway and say, it's okay. Even when it's operating, because there's nothing intrinsically wrong. It's all about the heart. And actually, am I even looking? I'm not going to look. I'm going to go. But you're not thinking about your brother or your sister. I'm not saying I'm right or wrong in any of these issues. I'm just trying to get you to think love, not just knowledge, not just kind of at the level of principle. Thinking about what we watch. I know some people who stopped watching Strictly Come Dancing because of the revealing costumes and the lewd dancing and the fact that the kind of essential compliment on Strictly is to say that was sassy, sensual, sexy. That's the kind of, you know, that's how you succeed in Strictly Come Dancing. Now, some of you will conclude, I don't want to watch that. That's what my conscience tells me. Some of you, I know, have concluded, I do want to watch that. It's okay. Now, I'm not saying all of you who are watching it, just for the sake of those who are not watching it, should now stop immediately. But did the thought ever enter your head that maybe you would stop because maybe you're causing your brother or your sister offense or maybe causing them to fall in some way by what you are watching, by what you are encouraging? That's what God's asking you to do, to think about it, to think through these issues. And there are many more things that in principle you may have concluded are right or neutral that you do, but by doing them you may cause other people to sin. Love will always think, how can I build up my brother, my sister? Knowledge will just think, what's the correct thing and what are my rights? What is my freedom? What's the logical conclusion? And we think logic, but we think more than logic as Christians. We think love. And maybe there are areas in each of our lives where we need to think a bit less knowledge and a bit more love. And where we need to see one another as people for whom Christ died. And people that we don't want to damage or destroy or defile in any way by anything that we do. God grant us the grace to do that.